Hello, friends. Patrick McFarlane here of the Liberty Weekly podcast, coming at you with another episode. This one is episode 153. Show notes may be found at libertyweekly.net/153. And I am on the horn with a longtime friend and supporter of the show, Theis. How are you doing, bud? Welcome back.
Yeah, good. It's been quite a while and quite a different world than since we last recorded. But right? Yeah, I'm good. Yeah.
I think there's been you were on the show twice, and I just want to drop the links for everyone who's listening. libertyweekly.net/77 and /40 were the two episodes that you were on. So, Theis, do you just want to reintroduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm Theis van der Linde. I'm currently 24 years old, a Dutch law student, or at least I graduated from my bachelor and I'm going into my master's. And since I think about 2012, I've been a libertarian, voluntarist, whatever you want to call it. So yeah.
Well, you predate me then, because I think I couldn't call myself a voluntarist until like 2016, I think, or 2015. Yeah. So you're going on to your master's degree, and as I understand it, how many years was your undergrad?
It's officially 3, but I had a couple of courses I had to retake, it took me longer. But yeah, 3 years and then 1 year master is usually the standard. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a type of law that you've kind of decided on?
I think I would like to do sort of at least private sector, corporate law, that sort of thing. Because I have also had administrative law and permits and stuff. But I definitely know I don't want to go in that direction. But something like a corporate attorney, corporate litigator, corporate advisor, something like that.
Awesome, yeah. And so, have you been going to school during the COVID situation?
That's quite interesting. So in March, I was doing a minor with marketing, and then the first 3 weeks or something, the first 2 weeks, they were like normal, just went to lecture, went to class, and then suddenly everything closed at once. So then immediately everything went on Teams and on everything was virtual, basically. And it was a bit of an adaptation, but I must say I kind of see some benefits as well with virtual. So in the past, I had 9 a.m. Tutorials and stuff. They had to travel for 90 minutes. So that's not a thing anymore. But I have been following classes and I did my thesis virtually as well.
Wow. Yeah. But for some people, that's not an issue. But for people like me, like, I have to get out of bed. I have to like go through the ritual of getting ready and then taking my son to daycare and then physically driving to the office and getting in the office. And like, I have my routine. You develop it at home, but you kind of sound like the person who thrives working remotely.
Yeah, I think I kind of like it, actually. Yeah, you do have a bit less personal contact. So I imagine when I start going into an internship, it might be a bit more difficult to get the startup phase. But honestly, like if I'm following my lecture, I might as well have a video. It doesn't really add that much to sit there in person. And maybe you can occasionally ask a question, but with Teams and all other software, you can do the same online. So now I just, instead of traveling a long time by train through the snow and rain and whatever, I just sit down at my desk and can go.
Well, so you said that before the lockdowns happened, your commute was 90 minutes?
Yeah, I had to. Utrecht is sort of a central city in the Netherlands, so I had to take 90 minutes by train to go there and 90 minutes back. So, if you have to leave at 7:30 to get to 9 a.m. and then 9 a.m. to 10:45 lecture and then another 90 minutes, it's quite a lot of waste.
Yeah, that's brutal.
Waste of time.
Are you at least able to do like homework and stuff on the train?
I suppose you could, but I don't really prefer it. And yeah, the seats are sort of the seat in front of you is sort of tilted back, so it's not really great with the laptop, and Wi-Fi is sketchy at best. So I do prefer to do everything at home.
Yeah,
yeah.
So what is how does it feel? What's the general consensus in the Netherlands about COVID situation? Has it changed since the beginning?
Well, not sure. It's kind of been weird because we've had like at first everyone said like it's 2 weeks or 4 weeks to stop the spread, and if okay, we'll do 2 weeks or we'll do 4 weeks. But we have had like I don't know 10 4 week extensions since March, so we've been chugging along, and yeah, most people do sort of accept it, but not everyone wears masks on the street, I've noticed, and yeah, but the tension has been building up. For example, restaurant entrepreneurs and so on, they've been out of, yeah, they've been closed for almost a year now, so they're really struggling, and yeah, they have had some stimulus type packages, but it's not really enough to replace having an actual business. So
yeah,
I think the tension has been building up a bit. Yeah.
So like around here, it really depends on where you are in the United States, at least. Like if you're in the country, most people don't wear it, and some people will look at you funny if you wear a mask. But if you're in the country, like you'll get daggers and everyone is wearing a mask. Like, so is it like if you were to go into the supermarket down the street, would there be people, everyone wearing masks?
Well, I went a couple times, but yeah, I most time I just wear one because I don't really want to deal with some know-it-all
right.
Come at me from why aren't you wearing it? Why aren't you wearing it? Go out, and so on. But yeah, when I'm walking down the street, some people have it, some people don't. It's a bit yeah. Most people are sort of I'll do the things that are legally mandatory, but everything else, like I'll just sort of let it hang. That's my impression.
Yeah. Well, in your national media, so do you know what's going on with the rioting and the protesting there?
Yeah, so a couple of I think 3 or 4 weeks ago we had a curfew instituted. So from 9 p.m. to 4:30 a.m., no one is allowed to go on site except for people with a valid employer excuse. And yeah, we've already had. Yeah, we do have, I think, compared to American states, we have a pretty extreme regimen because restaurants and movie theaters and so on have been closed forever. So, yeah, now people who normally would have gone out at night, now, yeah, they really can't do anything anymore. So, especially in the big cities, more like problem neighborhoods, everything it was, I guess the curfew was like the drop, final drop, and people started burning and looting and keep kicking at everything, and it was
so
pretty, intense for a couple of days.
I know, like is that still ongoing?
No, it took like 3 or 4 days, and the police at first was a bit unprepared, but right now they have more of a preventative attitude. So right before the curfew they start patrolling the streets and warning people and so on. So I think most people, yeah, it has, the momentum has sort of been crushed of these riots. But
okay,
yeah, it was really intense for 3 days or 4 days, and then it's fell off.
As a libertarian, how do you feel about the protests and the rioting? Because at least, you know, at the beginning with the George Floyd protests in the United States, I remember I had no idea how to feel about it. And at one point it was like, okay, well, we should condemn these people who are burning and destroying businesses and private property, no matter what. So what is your thought about it?
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. So I do think our measures are far too extreme for a reason. Like most people who actually do get in trouble from COVID, it's a very small group of the population who is over 70, and to close the entire society for that, I think it's... Yeah, it's like a curfew. We haven't had that since World War II, so it's really extreme for something that's not. I don't think it's like as extreme the virus itself. So I do support some kind of protest or even a little bit of resistance if absolutely necessary. But a lot of the people out rioting, I think they don't really care about the politics of it. They just want to burn things and they want to throw things. They want to. Like people who used to be hooligans, football hooligans, or so on. So I don't exactly think that this is also very productive for the state of liberty. They're just going to crush down harder. So there are some moral cases to be made for more forceful resistance, but I don't think it's effective, or most people who are participating actually care about politics. So that's part of my balance.
That's interesting, because that's what a lot of people around here thought too. And I'm, you know, I'm sure as being across the pond in Europe there, you know what's going on over here more so than we know what's going on over there. That's just kind of how I've observed it is with my European friends. But that's the way it kind of seemed with George Floyd and everything, all the riots this summer, is that, okay, well, some people were there explicitly for politics, but most of the people were there because they were just mad.
Yeah.
So do people over there feel like they can speak openly and freely about the COVID issue? And the reason I ask is because I was watching a video of a German doctor who was doing a live stream talking about how COVID was bunk or something like that, and he was raided on camera by the Polizei. So
yeah, as far as I know, I haven't really seen anything that extreme, but yeah, it's not a good time for speech. I can say that. It's of course, most people, as they're sitting at home, they express themselves on social media, but as you know, Facebook and Twitter and all those companies, they crack down on anything that's against the official narrative. So that has been limited, and now with COVID, they got a perfect excuse to also crack down on in-person meetings. So there are some very limited circumstances in which you can still do a street protest, but it's been severely restricted, and yeah, you can still say things, but yeah, it's getting more and more limited. And as I think I said in our last interview, we legally speaking, we don't have like a First Amendment in the Netherlands. We have one of those. Yeah, we're basically based on European law, and it says like you have the right to express yourself unless it is necessary to restrict this freedom by the needs of a democratic society. So like it basically doesn't really mean anything. Courts can just say, oh yeah, we agree with the politicians who think it should be restricted. So it's free speech as we understand it, we never really had anyway.
Like it's a loophole big enough to drive a train through, you know, like that's kind of how it is with constitutional law too. I was discussing with Dean, who's another lawyer, you know, law student friend of mine. He was saying that's all constitutional law is that they have these levels of review if you're going to infringe upon a right. And the lowest one is rational basis, which means that if the government can make any kind of case for the rationality of this law, then it will pass. So like in terms of federalism, over there is the Netherlands divided? Like, do you have counties? Do you have smaller states or districts?
Well, we have a unitary constitutional monarchy officially. So yeah, the king, and then you have a cabinet, a parliamentary system. So the state, Tweede Kamer, or the second chamber, they basically make the laws, and there's some review, but. Yeah, it's all very centralized, and we're not like Germany, who has a federal system. We're very centralized in that front, and we don't have a constitutional court, so also quite interesting. We basically don't the official. Yeah, there's like a second chamber, and they're officially supposed to test constitutionality, but that chamber is quite partisan as well. And yeah, we don't really have any hard checks and balances, in my opinion, of like the legislature can't do this and can't do that. We have more restrictions on the European level than on the national level of what our legislature can do. This is a strange system, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of like, so I studied in Switzerland for a little while, you know, about a month, and just going from the different cantons, they have a lot of autonomy over what the policy is going to be. Like in the United States, the governors, because the states have the police power, and they have more power over law and order type issues. So the governors were the ones who are propagating the lockdowns, and each state gets to decide its own policy. Is it like that in the Netherlands, where like now it's just centralized?
Yeah, it's basically the way our system works is everything flows from the legislature, the national legislature, and then they can delegate a couple of things to provinces and to municipalities. So recently, some healthcare has been passed on to the municipalities, and mayors actually do have a little bit of emergency powers to regulate local affairs, but everything, all of the criminal justice and environmental policies and basically everything that really matters, honestly, is decided at the national level.
Okay. Yeah. So, how does your, if you're comfortable talking about it, how does your family feel about all of it and your friends and everything?
Yeah. So, yeah, my parents are kind of, they sort of, in my opinion, follow the mainstream news opinion. So, yeah, if the media says you have to wear a mask, then you have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit frustrating, but I guess they're not going to change much about the political opinions, I think. But I do have one friend who is a bit more conservative libertarian, and he has been quite critical of the recent measures. But most people just sort of go along with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like that over here. I mean, except with the exception of like my family is very skeptical, and that's been refreshing because it's like, you know, as a libertarian and a content creator in this space, I've been very doom and gloom watching a lot of Peter Schiff and telling them that the sky is falling, you know, for so long now. And then all these things start happening and I feel like I should be vindicated a little bit.
Yeah. One thing I did follow on the American level is that school choice has actually been rising quite a bit because of these pandemic, because public schools, they want us to basically stay closed until 2025. And everyone is saying, yeah, our child is not receiving like education this way. And so we really want to, as Corey DeAngelis, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but as he says, he always says, like, let funding follow the child. So that's been a positive development as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to find silver linings. Like, I don't know, that's one of them is the silver lining. I think that on another level, the silver lining is that business owners who are really feeling the government boot on their throat are becoming red pilled.
Yeah, we have had some of that here, but part of my pessimistic part of me just wonders if they're just gonna blame it on a single party or on a single, like, we have had a same prime minister for 10 years now, so everyone basically says Rutte is the fault of everything. I hope that it leads to more general anti-government sentiment, but it might just as well be that when a left-wing party gets elected, suddenly people just, it's not that guy anymore, so now it's fine, and now the government should have the power.
It's very interesting how they fight for and claim that narrative too. It kind of seems like, I hate to say this, but after, in the wake of Ron Paul, you know, Ron Paul did a lot of amazing things for libertarianism across the world, but there was a certain part of his audience that was not, you know, dyed-in-the-wool pure libertarians. They liked his populist message in a way, but then when the next populist came around, they clung to that. So I'm wondering how the powers that be will try to frame the narrative in that respect.
Yeah. There were also here, there are a lot of people who are just anti things. So they're anti against the current cabinet. They're against immigration. They're against the EU, but they're also in favor of this Geert Wilders. I don't know if you ever heard of him. And he would like to get out of the EU. So I suppose that's a positive thing. But on domestic fronts, he just wants more power to police and more power to the fans. So yeah, it's not really progress on that front, I think.
Interesting. So would you say that he is comparable to like a Donald Trump populist type?
Yeah, I guess it's always a bit tricky to compare, because especially in Europe, we have a very strong devotion to the welfare state. And although Trump hasn't touched it so much, he has done a little bit more spending cuts and regulation cuts and so on. So yeah, all across the political board, the welfare state is basically untouchable. But when it comes to immigration and internationalism, he is quite comparable, I think, here to Geert Wilders.
Okay. And forgive me for my ignorance, but I don't know, is the Netherlands involved in like NATO's military incursions all over the world?
Well, we did send people to Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, as well. But I believe we still have people in Mali. But yeah, we have a very small army, so we can send some token UN group of units, basically, but to look at, oh, look, we're participating, but we're not like a major force. We're not like UK or France or anything. Sometimes we send like token force to show that we also are contributing some soldiers, but we're not a major military power.
Does it feel like the common person over there is against interventionism, at least? Or
well, I listen to the domestic debate. It's really all about domestic policies, and yeah, everyone talks about healthcare and stuff like that. And although that's also important, I think, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if most people don't know we ever really went to Mali, for instance. So yeah, I'm not sure. I think, yeah, so there is some opposition from the right, from let's just stay on our own borders, and that's some opposition from the left, but it's not like a uniting issue that really brings people out to vote.
Yeah, well, I suppose when, I don't know, like the United States, where what, 3/4 of your national budget is for defense spending,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
Where so much of it is. So do you kind of get the opinion that, okay, these protests and I guess riots, you could call them, have happened. Now the government is going to crack down even more with the preventative measures that you mentioned. But do you get the sense that the spirit of resistance is dead?
That's a tricky question. Like, I think most people are sort of like, you know, the story of the boiling frog that doesn't notice the temperature.
Yes.
So I think most people have sort of gone that direction. We just have to close 2 more weeks. We just have 4 more weeks. Then we can slow the spread. And yeah, people have sort of been led into that, thinking like every new measure is necessary, because something I say, like, if the numbers, COVID numbers, are going up, then we need to lock down harder, and if they're going down, that means the lockdown worked. So yeah, so there really is, yeah, a lot of people that isn't really debating that problem, so it's a bit tricky. But I do wonder in the next 3 months how many people are going to put up with more extensions and more extensions without any real prospects. And vaccination has begun, but that's also been I don't know how you followed it, but in Europe we are actually after Bulgaria, we're the slowest nation to vaccinate, so it's been kind of a mess.
Interesting.
That also has some resistance.
Yeah, that is interesting. Was the media and the government over there, were they able to spin these protests as being like so as a comparable in the United States, when January 6th happened and Trump supporters stormed the Capitol, I'm adding quotations for you listeners. When they walked into the Capitol, everyone was saying, oh, this is a 9/11 type event. This is like a complete assault on our democracy and everything like that. Was the media able to spin the protests that way over there?
Yeah, well, that was sure I have that exactly the same situation of marching people into the Capitol building. But yeah, after the riots, everyone really, the media conversation was really focused about violence against police is unacceptable. And that's sort of the refrain. And yeah, we haven't really been talking about underlying causes or issues. Or yeah, we haven't really had a solid lockdown debate, I think, on do we actually think this is worth as a general strategy, is it worth pursuing? Because everyone likes to talk about the lit up bus stations that are, you know, on fire, and yeah, that makes for a great picture on the front page, but that's not really talking about more fundamental issues. Yeah, I think we haven't had that conversation.
That's interesting. You made a good point there, just about how these events happen, and these protests and riots or whatever you want to call them happen, and the attention doesn't necessarily go to talking about the issue that they're rioting about. It goes to talking about the riot, which is the new issue.
Yeah.
In some way, I felt like that's kind of what happened in the United States over the summer, is that all of a sudden, you know, we're not going to have a conversation about whether or not we should lock down. Everything's going to be focused on, well, are cops racist, or, you know, institutional racism and the plight of minority folks. So.
Yeah, that's also something I've been thinking, like, BLM, yeah, okay, I sympathize with, like, people being shot by police unnecessarily, but then if you actually want to make a change, you have to propose something, you have to show a better way, and just, instead of just white people racist, police racists, white patriarchy, whatever, just shouting a bunch of slogans of how everyone who disagrees with the left is evil, like, that doesn't actually bring any positive political change. And yeah, you can just shout racism or shout bigotry everywhere, but it doesn't do anything to make people's lives better in a concrete way.
What did you think about this idea of defunding the police? Have you heard that, you know, in the conversation?
Yeah, I've heard it, and yeah, at first it was supposed to be like social workers or something, and then they said, and then the right said, yeah, well, we can't replace police with social workers. And the left said, yeah, but no, we weren't talking about it at all. We just want to cut a bit of the budget. And then, yeah.
Doesn't it
it's been kind of hard to follow what they actually mean and what they actually want. And of course, if you actually want a leftist, democratic, socialist society, you have to have some sort of police. And whether you call them police or commissars or people's militia, whatever, you have to have some sort of enforcement arm.
The People's Army of yeah, the state of Minnesota, the People's Republic of Minnesota. Yeah. Well, I think I mentioned this on the last time that we were talking together, but it's like every time I talk to like my European friends, I feel self-conscious about the fact that, like, I mentioned this before, you know, Europeans know what's going on in the United States, but we don't reciprocate on the other side. It's like, I don't know why that is with Americans, but
but honestly, America is kind of a cultural leader one way or another. Positive and negative trends, they come from America to Europe, and not much comes the other way around, I think. So
style, maybe.
Yeah, that's why he follows. Yeah.
Style maybe comes the other way around.
Yeah, fashion maybe, but yeah, I think sort of accurate with what people I don't remember who said it, but like Europe is history, basically. Europe is the beautiful cathedrals and everything, and America is sort of, since for the last 100 years, America has been the now and the future, basically. So Europe is sort of, yeah, it's not really, yeah, some people want the EU to take a leadership role, but I don't think it can. And yeah, most people in most countries in the world, either following America or they're following China or Russia or whatever. So yeah, that's the way this looks, in my opinion.
It's very interesting, like, the different perspectives that you get. There's so much different between our societies. I know, like, okay, it's very similar because we're both Western nations that are developed and the infrastructure is there, and the culture is very similar in a way, but in a lot of ways, the culture is very different too, but it's interesting to see how fundamentally it seems like our experience through COVID has been the same, because everything that you've said has been very, you know, similar here.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that. I'm not sure how it is in Minnesota, but some states have had a pretty, like Florida, I think, or something. They have had a pretty lax lockdown.
Yeah.
Maybe in the South, there are more soft, not as strict, but in California and New York, people are very strict. So that's a bit different, but I can definitely see how like media and politicians working together. This sort of has the same feeling on how this this whole thing is organized. Yeah.
It does, doesn't it? It's almost like they, you know, had discussed it beforehand, or at least at the very least were coordinating their efforts. Yeah, well, I mean, if you were to come here, I think you'd be surprised. I mean, just in my town, which is like maybe a couple hundred thousand people in the area, if there's a smaller town that's next to kind of a larger town, but the smaller town, you know, most places people aren't wearing masks or anything like that. They're not worried about social distancing or what have you. But, you know, you go to the one city over and it's totally different.
Yeah, I guess a sort of blue state, red state thing is also a big factor, because like Portland or something, everyone is very, very anal about this sort of thing.
Right.
But if you go to Eastern Oregon in Eastern Washington, in the more rural areas, people just don't really give anything to them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Hang on a sec there, Theis. Hi everybody, Patrick McFarlane here. Welcome to the part of the show where I tell you how you can help support this content. Of course, all these links will be at libertyweekly.net/support. But I do have Patreon, Subscribestar, float.app. I've been releasing exclusive content and bonuses in early access on Library, where you can get bonuses a la carte. So you don't have to subscribe for a monthly, you can just pick the bonuses that you want to watch. And you can support me with LBC, which is the cryptocurrency that Library runs on. So I have 3 episodes in the can already recorded waiting to be released that are available on Library and for Patreon supporters and Subscribestar and all that as well. Also, I wanted to advertise the second patron-only live stream that I'll be doing, where I join a Skype call and hang out with you patrons. We release that as bonus content as well. So the next one is coming up Friday, February 19th at 8 p.m. Central Time. Really looking forward to that. The first one was a blast. So we're going to be doing that again. And if you'd like to join that, that's available for you for only $5 per month. Also, I wanted to shout out my Substack columns. I've been doing that. I have crypto addresses as well on that support page. Also, I wanted to tease, I'm working on a book, and I'd really like to get that out. I've recruited the help of some Liberty Weekly listeners in the Discord channel to help give me feedback on that and get early access, and I'm offering an exchange and acknowledgement in the final edition of the book. So if you want to be involved with that, join me on Discord, libertyweekly.net/Discord, or send me an email at patrick.mcfarlane@libertyweekly.net. All right, so thanks so much for listening to the show. Of course, you can subscribe, rate, review to help support this content for free, or talk to your friends about it. I really do appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening. Now back to the show. Well, let's we got about 30 minutes left. Let's switch gears a little bit. So what I know that you've done your master's thesis. What did you do your thesis on?
I'm a bachelor's, I actually did.
Your bachelor's thesis. Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's a bit hard to explain because it's so different than the legal system, but yeah, so if it's about more like concerns, like I'm not sure what the good English term is, but like if a bunch of subsidiaries, one company owns a bunch of subsidiaries, you can call it a concern, and that parent company can exempt lower companies from having to publicize and submit a financial statement, but in turn they have to accept a liability for their debts, basically, if they exempt them from the financial statement. So the question is, the question I did my bachelor thesis on was, how far does that liability reach? And so in order to accept the liability for the lower company, you have to make a declaration of I accept it. And how does it stretch across time? What kind of obligations, past, present, and future, does it cover this acceptance of liability? So that's been it's quite a niche topic, but I suppose every thesis topic is sort of like
by necessity. I'm trying to think of the comparables here. Where so in the United States, the system in the U.S. is that you have different ways that you can decide to organize your company. There's like the limited liability entities have been a newer concept. And when I say new, I mean like the last 50 or 60 years, where you can have a limited liability entity by which you can organize your business. And the basic function of it is to shield the members or the owners of the company from personal liability for either business debts or obligations or tort liability or anything like that. So, you know, you get like corporations, LLCs, limited liability companies, and LLPs, limited liability partnerships. Is that kind of a similar arrangement over there?
We have, in terms of a kind of corporation, so you have like the BV that's close to the LLC, but not quite. So okay. You have to pay board members a certain salary of like $40,000 or something. So very small businesses usually organize in partnerships, but once they get a bit bigger, they become a BV. And then when it comes to listed companies, publicly traded, they usually become an NV. So that's more like I think you have like S corporation and C corporation or something. So yeah. NV is more like a C corporation, I think. So that's sort of it. But yeah, we have less options. We don't have LLPs or LLCs, so it has a bit more strict in terms of how much revenue do you have to have before you can actually afford to move up to a more complicated legal arrangement, legal system.
Okay. Yeah, and I know that there are certain tax implications for different. That might be some of the. This isn't my focus. My focus of studying these would be for like personal injury law. So, like, I assume I don't think your focus is personal injury, but I assume that there are certain ways that you can pierce the corporate veil.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that phrase because that's sort of what my thesis was about. Like, if you have if you have a contract with one of the smaller companies that's owned by a bigger company, that's through this liability arrangement that I've talked about with you. That's how you can
get at the larger. You can get at
the larger company especially if the smaller company goes bankrupt. And
So are you?
And there are also in terms of functional injury, there's all sorts of employer liabilities and so on. But that's outside of the scope of my thesis.
Okay. So I was going to ask if the scope of your thesis focused on, you know, these liabilities and debt obligations. When I say liabilities, I don't mean tort liability. I just mean, you know, debts or anything like that, or say that you breach a contract. How can I reach the owner of the company through the subsidiary? Okay.
Yeah, something like that. And I've also had bankruptcy law, and I've personally find it kind of fun to think about it. Sort of like normally when contracts just go well, everybody pays. But like when one company goes bankrupt, everybody just spreads out and looks for the biggest pocket to sort of try to reach at. And so we get sorts of different liability arrangements for how can we get to this shareholder, or how can we get to this company, and it's quite a complicated but quite an interesting interesting puzzle, I think.
That's kind of how like personal injury law works too, and you'll get juries when you do focus groups, when you're thinking about a case and taking a case to trial. A lot of what people will say is like, oh well, Why is this injured little girl going after the company? Well, it must be because the company has the biggest pockets. And it's like, okay, well, that does come into play into it. But no, it's because this girl has been wronged, you know? But juries will glob, they will just latch on to that idea. And it's just interesting the way that people think about that.
Yeah.
Mostly conservative folks will be like, it was you assumed the risk and it was your fault and you were acting stupidly. Or you know, you want to go after someone because they have the biggest pockets and because you're greedy or something like that. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting area of the law. So what do you have you from a libertarian standpoint, have you been able to form an opinion about whether or not you think that corporations would exist without the state? Because, you know, a lot of people say, well, the corporation designation is just something that's created by the government. And it's like, you know, this limited liability idea is something that is bestowed by government onto a business entity. I haven't like really examined this topic, but do you have any opinion on that?
Well, I am. At first, I didn't quite know, but I found quite an interesting lecture by Jeroen Broek of the Objectivist Circle area, sort of. He makes kind of an interesting point, like there are, of course, two liabilities. One is, generally speaking, within a contract, and one is without a contract. So within a contract, it's kind of obvious, I think, if you make a contract with an LLC, you know that it is an LLC, then you have accepted that limited liability. So I don't think in a free market, people wouldn't try to make contracts like that. And I think it just should be recognized if people do make contracts like that. And in the case of tort liability, for example, if like a driver, let's say a driver of a particular truck, they hit a pedestrian. Normally you would sue the driver anyway, just because the owner of the van doesn't necessarily become liable for that accident. So that's sort of a similar construct, I think, with tort law, because if I don't know, KFC delivers and the KFC driver runs into a pedestrian, it's not necessarily people who have invested in KFC that have actually anything to do with that liability. So I think corporations do sort of make sense from a libertarian free market sense, but I'm interested in hearing other opinions.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about that. So, like in the United States, in a tort concept, if the driver of a KFC van, if he is operating within the scope of his employment and he hits someone and paralyzes them, the victim, the one who is paralyzed, could sue the driver of the van, the driver's private car insurance company, and he could sue KFC and KFC's insurance company. But you're right. I don't think it's the fact that the driver would be able to reach into the pockets of the shareholders necessarily in that instance. It would be that, I mean, of course, you would go after the limits of liability that the insurance contract for KFC has. Usually that would be enough coverage. And if not, you would get some kind of a lien against, I don't know, KFC's assets, or if they have liquid assets to pay some kind of settlement out of. That's how it would work in the United States. But you go into those theories of agency. Have you studied that at all? Like, it's like when someone represents you. So in terms of like, if you're a hospital and you have volunteers, they come in and they help patients. When the patients get to the door and they help take the patients to the doctor, is that person your agent for terms of respondeat superior? So if that volunteer is negligent and hurts one of the patients before they take the patient to the doctor, is the hospital liable? Is the volunteer an agent of the hospital? Some would say yes, like if they're wearing a uniform. That'd be called ostensible agency, is that you're putting the volunteer out as a representative of your entity, even if you're not paying them to do it. It's just kind of the concept.
Yeah, I'm not exactly super familiar with the common law regulations about that, but I do know in Netherlands we have like employer liability, so that's certainly would cover the KFC case. Or we have a couple of things like you can be liable for pets, for instance, or for children, or what you call those general like risk liability. So even if you haven't done anything wrong, you still, it's still your sphere of responsibility. But I think, yeah, those sort of make sense somewhere. But yeah, I think trying to go all the way to about the corporate subject, so trying to go all the way to the shareholders, it's a bit far-fetched, because just because I gave you money to start a delivery company, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I have anything to do with managing the company or with safety standards or anything like that. So that's, I personally think corporations would make sense in that that context.
Okay. Yeah, and for the listeners too, it's that the American system is based off of the common law system that we've discussed, but in the Netherlands you have a civil law system, right? So everything is based off of statute.
Yeah, largely statute. So it's kind of long story, but it goes back to Romans and then Napoleon, I think, and then then it sort of evolved into through different continental countries. But every liability must have some basis in statute. So we have like contracts, and we have sort of a couple of like torts. Yeah, it's not exactly called tort, but a similar concept. And every liability must somehow evolve back to a statute.
So there's not a disconnect, but the thing that we're discussing is when I say respondeat superior, that's a common law concept. But what you're saying is that, well, you have employer liability. So is that employer liability codified in the statute?
Yeah, so we have like a, it's called like a civil book of laws in very rough translation. So we have like eight or nine books. Every book covers a different, so one is family, two is corporations, three is more general principles of legal acts, and six is contracts and so on. So every situation that the legislator wanted to create a liability for has somehow been squeezed into one of those books, and that's where you can find employer liability, for example, or product liability.
So when the legislatures in a when the legislators in a civil law system are looking to codify, some kind of concept, what do they look at specific court cases to try to emulate what was done in that court case, to try to replicate it or codify the rule from it?
Well, it's this sort of it's technically different, but not very different. So usually the legislature puts out a law, for example, some laws about how we organize partnerships, they date back from to the 1800s, basically.
Yeah.
So they're not very recent. And then the highest court, they officially interpret it to be this way. And then maybe 10 years later, then the legislature looks at it and says, oh, do we like this? Then I either leave it in place, or maybe if they don't like it, they'll change the law. But the highest court system sort of picks up a lot of the slack in terms of what the legislator didn't think about. So it's not technically stare decisis, but the higher courts do have quite a bit of influence on how those narrower details are actually interpreted and applied.
And for the listeners too, the concept of stare decisis is just looking at past precedent, basically, right?
Yeah. So yeah, we don't technically have like binding precedent, so that a court system can actually dictate the law. But most legislators they don't really look at intricacies of civil law. They're just concerned with winning the election, you know.
So, yeah. Right.
So 20 years after the court decides a case, they might think, oh, maybe we don't like this, or maybe we do like this, and then they might change the law, they might not. But yeah, they do technically have the power to overrule the higher chords, but they usually just follow because they don't want to really be bothered with with that sort of precise stuff. Yeah.
They don't want to. So does the legislature? Does the legislature ever run into a problem where by changing the law they end up hurting people in a way? Like, so I hope I can communicate this well, but in Wisconsin we have what's called the statute of repose, and that means that you can't sue for defects in the construction of a property. If the property has been exposed for a period of 10 years or for more than 10 years, you can't sue for a defect in the way it was constructed. Well, the legislature took that and they shortened it to 7 years. So theoretically, if you shorten it to 7 years, there's a 3-year gap of people who, you know, would have had, they would have had causes of action to sue, but because it was shortened by those 3 years, they're not allowed to anymore. I can't remember what that's called. Ex post facto. Does that ever come up?
Well, I can't specifically think about a problem like that, but I do know one example that comes to my mind is in our system with damages. We don't really have punitive damages, or more like, yeah, we've always, for the last 100 years, we've been very focused on economic damages. So that's really all you can sue for. And some people have said, yeah, well, we want to avoid American circumstances with like $1 million for someone who slips on slips on the floor. But there have also been some really extreme cases, like someone, like a mother who, yeah, it's a bit graphic, but a mother who saw her child die from a taxi backing up and all sorts of bloody gore. And she really couldn't sue for anything, but yeah, because it wasn't financially, didn't fall in the financial bracket. So that's sort of a thing that the legislators, they really didn't think about, but the courts were like kind of wrecking their brain, like, we want to compensate these parents, but we don't really have a basis for it. And now, the last few years, they finally had some limited tiers of like emotional damage, something like that. So, yeah. So it's a question that we get a, when it comes to tort law, we get very freaking comparisons to America, like $1 million settlements and so on. But
that's hilarious.
Yeah, you could argue that's too far of extreme, but I think we had in the past, we had too far on the other end as well.
It's interesting because I'm thinking about there's case law and common law precedent for infliction of emotional distress when say that a mother and a daughter are driving in a car together and they get totally crushed by like I don't know a dump truck and the younger daughter has to watch her mother die, you know, the daughter has a cause of action merely for watching her mother die. Like that. Yeah. So yeah, or if there is a wrongful death suit, like someone was killed wrongfully in a car crash or something, and if it took them an hour or two to die, and if they went through intense pain in that hour or two in fear of imminent death, you can get damages for that too. So
yeah. In the past, the example of the daughter who saw the mother dying, in the past it would have been like, you could only calculate like what money the mother would have made until the daughter was 18 or something like that. You know, that was really the only damages that you could compensate for that. And I sort of,
dang.
Yeah, I get that you want to limit liability to avoid extremes, but I think that's kind of another extreme entirely. So yeah,
it's
all just economic creatures, paychecks are the only thing that should be compensated.
Oh, right. That very stringent, rigid kind of idea. So you remember the concept of like Wehrgeld, like in Beowulf, this concept of what I thought was the roots of personal injury law way back in the Anglo-Saxon system was this idea of liquidated damages for bodily injury. So like the courts would say, oh, losing an ear is, you know, 5 pence or whatever the money was. It's funny. It's kind of like that is you have this idea of, you know, you have economic damages that you, of course, want to be compensated. But how do we put a price tag on losing a part of your body or losing your daughter or watching, you know, going through those subjective experiences? And then you get a jury in the United States that will award $4 million, you know?
Yeah. So we've in Europe, I think specifically in the Netherlands, probably in other European countries as well, we've sort of, we think like, instead of addressing those types of problems through civil law, we're just going to, like, we're going to fine the person who did it with administrative fines, or we're going to address it criminally, but we're not going to, we're not really going to give any private cause of action for that sort of specific term. Yeah, we have sort of a focus on central state action, as it were, instead of like a private person's rights who have been violated.
That's interesting because, you know, I mean, that's kind of the way the criminal law is going in the United States is like, well, you know, a crime is a crime against the state. Even if you were mugged, you know, by someone and, you know, they beat you over the head with a Glock, the crime that they committed is technically against the government.
Yeah, that's definitely very European, continental European idea.
All right. Well, it's been great to have you on. I want to give you a chance. You want to tell the audience like what you've been working on? Do you want to plug anything or what do you got?
Yeah. So my current sites, although a bit inactive, they are still operational. So GaiusLib.com is my website for blog and podcasting and stuff.
Okay.
And yeah, we are adding into the general election as well in March. So if you're interested in Dutch politics, stemlp.nl is always good to look at.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I will, I'll put those links in the show notes page at libertyweekly.net/152. And so my hope, Theis, is that it's not going to be a 3 or 4 year gap between the next time that we speak on the podcast.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Yeah.
A lot of stuff has happened since then, but I'm looking at the dates of your last appearance, May 27th, 2018, and November 9th, 2017. So,
yeah.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on so much. And I really hope that, you know, we see each other soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And let's see what the future is going to bring.